Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce T.J. Stiles tonight, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for an earlier book on Vanderbilt, and now having finished a book, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier of a New America, a new look at a very controversial figure who, again, comes down to us in only one or two major images or scenes when he had a very rich life. T.J. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you all turning out tonight. I'd like to start by noting that Custer liked to eat raw onions. In the Yellowstone Expedition of 1873, he sent a letter to his wife, which mentioned that on the way back, he'd found a store of raw onions and had raw onions for dinner, for breakfast, and for lunch. And as he ate a large chunk of raw onion, he said he told himself, "Enjoy yourself now, my boy, because soon school will be in session." I don't think his wife liked raw onions. He also liked to eat broiled rattlesnake, or rather, more importantly, he liked people to know that he ate broiled rattlesnake. Now we would call him an extreme eater. The air of being an extreme eater was more important to him, actually, than the food itself. He loved fine art. He particularly loved the Hudson River School. And one of his happiest moments is when he had lunch in the studio of an artist he particularly admired. He was interested in science. Again, on the Yellowstone expedition, he spent a great deal of time collecting fossils and sending back samples to Audubon clubs and to the Smithsonian. He loved the theater. He was passionate about the theater and, in fact, cosmopolitan culture in general. One of his best friends was Lawrence Barrett, who was a leading actor of the day, and who he continually wrote to inviting him out on Western expeditions. And in 1874, he invited him to join him on the expedition that went into the Black Hills, ultimately leading to Custer's death. And his friend Barrett wrote back essentially that he preferred wearing a wig on stage to losing his scalp to the Indians. Custer loved dogs. He was passionate about his dogs. Again, using 1873, because there are some wonderful letters that he wrote because he had plenty of time to write to his wife. He said, I think I'm going to become more attached to luck, which is interesting because Custer himself wrote of Custer's luck, which was a part of his legend even during his lifetime. I think I'll become more attached to luck than any dog I have ever owned. She comes to me almost every evening when I am sitting in one of my large, comfortable camp chairs, listening to the band or the officers in conversation. First, she will come and lay her head on my knee as if to ask if I am too much engaged to notice her. A pat of encouragement, and her forefeet are thrown lightly across my lap. In a few moments, in this posture, she gently and quietly disposes of herself in my lap, and at times she will cuddle down and sleep there for an hour at a time. I can transfer her gently to the ground, and she will continue her slumber like a little baby carefully deposited in the crib. As I write, she is lying at my feet. Curiously, both Custers loved dogs, and neither of them, that's an important point, they did not have children. So I mention these things about Custer not because they're definitive, but because it's important to remember when we face up to the image of Custer that looms so large in the American mind. We remember him not only as a corpse, as the man who died at the Little Bighorn, we remember him as an effigy. He is someone that, in American memory, we set on fire to pay for the sins of the United States as a nation. Now, some of that is deserved. He was controversial during his lifetime. Some of it is not deserved. Sometimes we'd rather put on him things that were a part of much larger national developments and federal policies. But it shows us two things. One, such points about Custer reminds us that he was a human being. And capturing him before his death as a human being is central to my book. But also, that controversy comes from the fact that he was a volatile individual. His personality played a role in his controversy then and now. But also that he was immersed in great questions. My book, Life on a Frontier of a New America, the subtitle, speaks of the fact that Custer lived on a frontier in time. And so as a result, he was immersed in conflicts that defined the United States to this day. And being Custer, he faced up to them, he threw himself into them, but in a volatile, sometimes self-destructive, sometimes admirable, sometimes utterly repugnant ways. He was someone who never saw a frying pan without immediately jumping into the fire. He created disasters for himself. He got out of disasters for himself. He was passionate. He left volumes and volumes of letters that speak to his inner state. Through Custer, we see not only someone who played a direct public role, but someone who shows the private experience of going through some of the most tumultuous and transformative moments in American history. Now, I don't have time to recount his entire life. He died at the age of 36, and yet during that lifetime, he had immersed himself in so many events that I could talk for 5 days and not cover everything. Fortunately, I'm only going to be here for 5 hours. The door is locked. You can't leave. No, we have about half an hour. So I want to focus on one moment that illustrates this volatile personality, this self-destructive tendency, and yet also admirable characteristics and also repugnant characteristics that make Custer so fascinating, and also show how his life was something that spoke to Americans about their times. He was controversial and a celebrity going into the Little Bighorn. That's why we remember the Little Bighorn so well today. If people like Wesley Merritt or Nelson Miles, people who only the Western history buffs will remember, if they had died at the Little Bighorn, I don't think it would have been quite the same event. But Custer went into it as a national celebrity and a nationally notorious figure, depending on your point of view. So I want to take an earlier moment. My book does not focus on the Little Bighorn. It focuses on his life leading up to it. Let's take his second, not first, but second court-martial in 1867. It took place in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The date was September 16th, 1867, when it began. And it was a remarkable downfall for an individual who 2 years earlier had been a national hero. Well, except from the South. He had been a national hero for the Union, as a ending the war as a major general of U.S. volunteers at the age of 25. He was someone who had contributed immeasurably to the Union victory, someone who was not simply courageous, but actually was, this is one of the surprises in my book, had been a real professional, a real gifted combat leader, someone who had helped to win major battles that directly contributed to the Union victory. When Lee surrendered at Appomattox Courthouse in the home of a man who bizarrely had also lived on the battlefield of First Bull Run, don't buy real estate next to this man. They had the surrender ceremony in this man's house, and General Sheridan, who was head of the Union Cavalry and Custer's mentor at that point in his life, his sponsor, purchased the small end table on which General Grant had written the surrender document. And he gave that table to Libby Custer, Custer's wife. And he said, "No man has contributed more to this great accomplishment than your husband." And he meant it. Custer was a division commander, sort of a mid-level general during the Civil War, and probably one of very few, if I wouldn't say the only, but one of very, very few division commanders who was a household name. Now, why was that? Again, this speaks to the meaning of the man in the times. Of course, as I said, he was very gifted at combat. It was the one thing in his life, despite his horrific end. Most people are simply have to worry about the fact of death, not how they die. With Custer, he got it. Both were a problem for him. He died horribly in combat, and we remember him as a bad commander as a result. In fact, combat was the one area in which he was always sure of himself, always self-assured, never insecure, always calm and collected. And this began very early on in his life. So he was not only good at it, but also it's the air that he carried. It was the personality that he cultivated. During the Civil War, we now estimate that at least 750,000 Americans died. That is vast number, vastly more than any other war. It may be more than all of our wars combined. It's certainly more than almost all of our wars combined. It was well more than 2% of the U.S. population. Everybody had suffered a loss. You had long-range rifles and rifled artillery that allowed mass infantry formations to just decimate attacking troops in particular. Men became disillusioned. The generation that went to war in 1861, they imagined that there would be a short war. Every soldier thought that he would be engaged in personal combat with the enemy, capturing a flag, a war of individual heroics and gallantry. And the war shattered those illusions. So we come out of it, that romantic atmosphere, that romantic heroic culture that Americans had been challenged deeply by the war. Not shattered completely, but challenged. So we have very dark intellectual figures who come out of the wartime experience. Ambrose Bierce, who is probably the most cynical and darkest writer in American history, who was deeply engaged in infantry combat. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who became the most realistic juror in American history. He wrote after the Overland Campaign of 1864, "It is kill, kill all the time. I am not the same man I was who went to war. My ideas have changed." And you have other figures who didn't take part in the fighting, like Mark Twain and Henry Adams. Henry Adams' brother, Charles Francis Adams Jr., a major intellectual figure who actually did fight in the Union Army. They come out of the war with a much darker sensibility that we recognize, having lived through having read the literature of the generations who fought in World War I and World War II and the Vietnam War. We are now very familiar with the modern sensibility of what war means. It means random death. It means individual gallantry and heroics get crushed by random moments and by enemy firepower. Machinery destroys the individual. It's a horrible thing. And this sensibility begins in America in the Civil War, but not with Custer. Custer was someone who fought in this sidelight of the Civil War, important to the war, but it wasn't the main event. Cavalry fought mostly other cavalry. Instead of having long-range rifles and large massed formations, they fought often on horseback. Custer made use of the new technology, but he, like most cavalrymen, often fought on horseback against other cavalry. They fought with revolvers. They still fought with sabers. Custer was someone who lived and won in part because he personally fought well. He may be the last American general to kill someone else in a sword fight. So this is a very old, romantic, chivalric, almost medieval idea of warfare. And then he cultivates an image which goes back to this very romantic idea that's living mostly in the South. He has this long golden hair. When he's appointed a brigadier general at the age of 23 through his connections, but also because of his merit, he shows up not just in a standard general's uniform, but it's black velveteen. He has gold braid coiled up to his sleeve from cuff to elbow. He has a blue sailor shirt tufted out over the back with big silver stars in the corner, and a huge white hat and a red necktie. Now, this seems like ridiculous vanity, and certainly there's a lot of vanity in Custer. And yet, we have to remember it actually serves a purpose, and it also has a cultural effect. The purpose is that this is still a battlefield in which, you know, men are fighting within view of their commanders. Orders are not being transmitted by radios, which don't exist. For the brigade, which Custer commanded, it's not being transmitted by written orders. They're looking for flags. They're listening for bugles. They're listening for bands. Things that seem ridiculous to us now were an important part of command and control. And Custer rode at the head of his troops. It was a statement of his personal courage, because they would see him if he was going to lead a retreat. They also see him if he leads a charge, a statement of his personal belief and his personal skill. And it's also serves a valuable purpose in inspiring and actually physically directing his men. "We're going to go here. Follow me. And follow me, or come on, you Wolverines," as he famously said to his Michigan troops. This was emblematic of Custer. And we know from his troops' writing about how they saw him. They saw that he would fight like they did. They would fight in their midst, and he fought well, and they won under him. It was a war of peoples. This is where millions of people went to war to win the Civil War, and they wanted to win. They weren't just draftees. They were troops who wanted to win, and he was a leader who fought with them, who fought well, who led, and he won. And so he does it with this romantic style, and it appeals to the public. The press writes about him as the boy general of the golden locks. And he engages in the changing nation in other ways, too. They're very admirably in some ways. He, for example, marries during the Civil War an extraordinarily well-educated woman, Elizabeth Bacon. She was known as Libby to all, who had the equivalent of an undergraduate education at a time when only 1% of men graduated from college. And She was charming. She was witty. She understood her appeal to men. Sometimes I look back at people who are considered attractive over time, and I just don't get it. She is a beautiful woman, and she understood her appeal. And she not only was someone who he loved to talk to and enjoyed her intellect, but when he was a general, she went to Washington, and she served as his personal liaison, maintaining his political support in Congress. It's one reason why he didn't run for office later, because she, having dealt with politicians, told him, you are not going to run for office. You're not going into that snake pit. And so then the new place of women, as they're beginning to push back at this time, the women's movement is beginning to develop. And though she's not a women's rights advocate, she certainly represents the more assertive and the more well-educated woman who's now coming on the scene. He also hired an escaped slave, Eliza Brown, as his cook. She's a woman on the left. She was not merely his cook. She was a remarkable woman who took advantage of her new circumstances to create a zone of personal safety and a zone of authority for herself. So she begins to build her own patronage network, distributing food from the general's mess to other contrabands, as they called escaped slaves. She butters up, literally butters up biscuits, for visiting couriers from other headquarters. She acquires information. She trades information. Having lived her life in slavery, she knows how valuable information is. She asserts her personal power and her personal force of personality and maintains her personal security in a unit of white men. She's a young teenage black woman, very physically vulnerable, and yet she maintains her personal security both through the respect that the men give Custer and also through her own force of personality. And then finally, she also is someone who, when Libby shows up, she's diplomatic enough to deal with Libby in a way that maintains her authority. Libby, after all, is a woman who's only allotted so much power in 19th century America. Women are supposed to control the household. She shows up in the middle of the Civil War and finds there's this young black woman who's running the household. Eliza Brown, this precious little piece of authority she's gotten and her standing in her own community of escaped slaves depends upon her control of the household. So she can't alienate Libby, but she doesn't want to lose power to Libby. Well, she spent her whole life negotiating relationships across the color line, dealing with people who have literally the power to kill her if they want to. And she adroitly outmaneuvers Libby. Now, it's not that, you know, they were constantly at odds. There are two women in a very male sphere in the wartime, especially, as well as afterwards. They were allies. They were friends. When they go west, they help save men in a flash flood together. They deal with hardships together. And yet also there is a growing, over time, a growing struggle for power that's sublimated, that's subtle, and yet the two women begin to have this conflict over who's in charge. So this is Custer's personal engagement with the way in which the Civil War changes America. He's very conservative politically. He comes from a very political family. His father very firmly believes in slavery. His father was from Maryland, a slave state. His father's deeply racist. Custer shares a lot of those views, and yet the practical experience of war, the experience of actually meeting black people like Eliza Brown, has an effect on him. He writes proudly of having to help free slaves. When they go to Texas after the war in Louisiana, Eliza Brown cultivates the Custers and shows them what slavery was like, brings them into slave quarters, shows them the backs of people who'd been whipped and bear the scars of hundreds of whippings. Custer is writing things about how every plantation has its Simon Legree. And yet at the same time, the end of the war, Custer's a national hero, and the end of the war presents a question to him, what kind of a country is this? And as he goes to occupation duty in Texas, he begins to confront this question very personally. He deals with a case of a young black girl who's 9 years old, who'd still been held in de facto slavery, and was murdered for leaving the plantation where she was kept and trying to find her mother. She finds her mother, and soon afterwards comes a son from the a family that had owned her, and the son horribly murders her. Custer is the occupying authority. He's in charge of dealing out justice. He has the boy arrested. He thinks it over, and he says, you know what? The federal government shouldn't be involved. And he turns him over to the local authorities, who, of course, were the Confederates who'd been running things under slavery, and the boy is let go. And so his personal sympathy, his humanity, which is very real, is in conflict with his deeply held political views and racial views. So Custer is hardly an exemplar, but he's not some evil villain. He is a human being, and the worst thing about him is that he is an exaggerated version of many Americans at this time. So he comes back in 1866, and again, I fault him for that. I think that there were other Union soldiers who were facing the same questions Custer was and were coming to different conclusions. That's the thing. You put him in the context of the time, but you also look at other people who are making different choices, and you see that it is a choice. He's making that choice. Meanwhile, Libby is also getting more and more frustrated, and she's writing in more explicitly racist terms as she has this growing conflict with Eliza Brown, who she likes and admires. So they come back to Washington. Custer throws himself into politics. Now, there's a practical reason for this. He is named lieutenant colonel. His regular army rank, he actually gets promoted, long story. So he's not demoted from general. He's promoted in the regular standing army to lieutenant colonel. And General Grant names him head of the field commander. Lieutenant Colonel would effectively lead the regiment of the 9th U.S. Cavalry, one of the new black regiments that are put into the regular army after the Civil War. Custer writes over the head of Grant to President Andrew Johnson and says, "I only want to serve with white troops." And so Johnson, at this moment, is beginning a huge conflict with Congress over Reconstruction, over what does emancipation mean. And he has just vetoed the first Civil Rights Act. Johnson has vetoed an extension of the Freedmen's Bureau bill. He says explicitly, white men must rule the South. And he goes on a campaign in 1866 called the Swing Around the Circle to defeat the Republicans, to defeat the proposed 14th Amendment, the basis of all civil rights laws, and indeed civil liberties in America. And he wants to defeat this. And he takes a number of generals with him and famous Union heroes, including Custer. Well, most of them stay in they kind of are embarrassed by the political nature of this tour, but Custer is out on the platform right next to Johnson, hectoring the crowd, speaking for him. Custer becomes a political delegate to what is essentially the Democratic Party convention that year. He organizes a political convention of soldiers and sailors to support Johnson's cause in the midterm elections. Now, what happens is that the North sees this racial question in terms of wartime loyalty. And so for a brief moment, the Northern voters, white voters, are actually firmly in favor of civil rights because they see it as standing up against the rebels as they try to oppress the only loyal population of the South, the former slaves. So for a moment, race is pushed aside. They give overwhelming majority to the Republicans, and Custer comes under fierce attack. Now, this is important to remember that Custer first becomes controversial not because of the Indian Wars, but because of racial politics, because of the politics of Reconstruction, and he's very firmly on the wrong side. And Libby saw it all coming, and she's very frustrated and very upset. She'd narrowly stopped him from running for Congress. He'd been asked. So Custer gets his reward. He's shifted from the 9th Cavalry to the 7th Cavalry, which is a new white regiment. But as he goes west, he has the fact that his celebrity has now been tarnished. He's now notorious as well as celebrated. So people love him, but now there's newspapers that have condemned him and have mocked him, and he's a lot of voters and northern people are upset with him. He's also created a crisis in his marriage, where in 1866, Libby was tending to her dying father in Michigan. He went to New York, where he was feted by the wealthy stockbrokers and Democratic kingmakers, and where he finds that women are really interested in him as a young general who has this very flamboyant air. And he'd always been a ladies' man, as his West Point classmate said. And he's not content with simply enjoying the company of women. He's constantly writing back to Libby, talking about all the women who are interested in him and how, you know, a woman was following him on the street and then he followed her. And it's this kind of underside of Custer's flamboyance, his ambition, is a neediness. He wants to be great. He's always afraid that he's that obscure nobody from southern Ohio. He's always afraid that people won't admire him. He's kind of desperate for attention. And it makes him fragile and makes him vulnerable. And so as he comes under attack politically, as he's now notorious, it makes him brittle, makes him defensive. So he goes west in 1866. 1867, he takes part in the very first Indian campaign. Now, of course, the nature of the warfare is very different from the conventional wars of the East. But he certainly has a great deal of trouble with it. The expedition he's on, the whole purpose is to intimidate the Southern Cheyennes and Oglala Lakotas so that they don't create trouble. And in the book, I talk about the environmental history of the Great Plains, how the roots of the conflict, historians now believe, were not simply land grabbing, but as American migrants and trade passed through the Great Plains to points west, including California, they were degrading river valleys, you know, cutting down timber, making it much more difficult for the Indians to maintain the nomadic lifestyle, the bison hunting, horse mounted lifestyle, which was very dependent upon very slender natural resources. And that lifestyle was very unstable. The economics of it were very unstable environmentally. And the passage of thousands of migrants and of U.S. troops and of forts kind of tilted the balance. And so a lot of the warfare actually predated the March of Settlement, and it had to do with the environmental impact. So the Army comes in and says, basically, you've got to stop attacking our migrants. And the Indians are basically explaining, you're cutting down timber, you're ruining the water sources, you're making it life untenable. And the Army just doesn't get it. They don't understand it. So they provoke a war, and Custer is sent out to chase after the Southern Cheyennes and Lakotas who've gone off into the Great Plains to start fighting back. And he shoots his horse while off on a little buffalo hunting expedition of his own, miles away from his column in the middle of hostile territory. Fortunately, he was good at dead reckoning, and the column finds him, kills his horse two more times that year. Not the same horse. And he loses the Indian trail. He encounters an Oglala war leader named Pawnee Killer who tricks him. Then later on, tricks Custer into giving him supplies and then rides off. Later on, Custer's camp is attacked. Custer signals for parley. Turns out it's Pawnee Killer. Pawnee Killer says, oh, it was a big mistake. Tell you what, follow us back to our camp and then we'll get our stuff and we'll go in with you. We don't want to fight. So Custer mounts his men. They follow the Indians. The Indians go a little faster. The Lakotas go a little faster. They disappear. They come back to the camp, and they find they've circled around and looted the camp while they were gone. Pawnee Killer was pretty funny. He was also lethal. They find a small escort of about a dozen troops carrying a message from a fort from General Sherman to Custer. They find it's been ambushed and completely wiped out by the same Lakota force. So this warfare just overwhelms him. And yet, I think that Custer's problem in this year is not so much the challenges of this new kind of warfare. Yes, that was a challenge for him. It's that he was obsessed with getting back to his wife. It's that he's feeling fragile and vulnerable. He's lashing out at his troops over minor things. He's levying outrageous discipline over minor infractions. He's fragile. He's vulnerable. He obviously has gone into this conflict having immersed himself in the great conflicts of the day politically, having become a national pariah in many quarters. He's feeling challenged. He's not at his most confident. And then he's created this problem with his wife, which I think is focused on the fact that when they went west, they brought a young, attractive friend of his wife's who had written to her about how she was jealous that he'd married Custer. Later, there's a letter from a woman with the same name that Custer got saying, oh, you know, I miss you. I wish we were together. I heard a song. It made me think of you. There's evidence to think that there was a flirtation or maybe more than flirtation. And Custer's off in the plains, and his wife is there with this woman he might have been doing something with. He wants to get back and fix that situation and settle it down as soon as possible. That's my suspicion. And that's he certainly wants to get back to her. And so finally, he just abandons his men. He takes 70 troops as a special escort, rides back. Some of his troops get ambushed. Two men get shot. He just leaves them behind, doesn't even tend to them, and gets back, and he gets arrested and court-martialed. And he thinks it's a great outrage. All his life, this charismatic, young, talented, yet volatile young man has had the rules bent for him. And now the rules are not being bent for him. And he deserved to be court-martialed. And he can't stand it. He nearly gets court-martialed again because not content with taking a very mild punishment of a year's suspension, he writes a letter to a newspaper complaining about how it was all, you know, unfair prosecution. And so there's a discussion between Grant and the Judge Advocate General of the Army saying, you know, this is conduct, unprofessional conduct, and he should be court-martialed again. Grant holds off. He was looking at running for president, and purging the army of Johnson's enemies probably wouldn't look too good. But mostly I think it's the fact that Sheridan was his patron, and Sheridan was one of Grant's right-hand men. So he holds off. A year later, Custer comes back. He goes into his first chance to really fight a major battle against the Indians in 1868, and he fights and wins it. But again, it's very controversial. For reasons that he bears some blame for, even though he followed orders. He attacked a village in the middle of winter. This was standard army tactic, actually. Women and children were in the firing line. He tried to stop troops from shooting them, but he knew they'd be in the firing line. But the thing that he did try to do, that he was ordered to do, and then he makes a point of doing, is bringing back no men of fighting age alive. So at the end of this battle, he followed the trail of a war party there. I don't think he's particularly guilty for picking a village that was led by Black Kettle, one of the great advocates for peace among the Southern Cheyennes. He happens upon that village. I don't think he deserves special blame for that. But he did carry out an atrocity. He was ordered to kill or hang all the men, he was told by Sheridan, and they brought back no men alive. So I think it was an atrocity. In any other setting, the army would have considered it a war crime. But not against American Indians. They didn't. He was ordered to do it, and he did it. And ironically, one of the ways we can see that Custer bears some culpability, not complete culpability, like I said, is a standard Indian warfare, and yet Custer himself, later on in the same campaign, he cornered a Southern Cheyenne village, but they had two white women captives. So instead of attacking immediately, which would have led to their deaths, he has negotiations. He acts very, very ruthlessly. He takes hostages of four leading men, but that convinces them to come in and surrender rather than fleeing. So he actually finds a way to accomplish the same results without bloodshed. And he frees women hostages. Most of the Cheyennes come in and surrender. And even though it's ruthless, it's not an attack on a village full of noncombatants. At the Washita, where he built his reputation as an Indian fighter, also controversial at the time. Also, people are divided over his conduct. And indeed, in this case, again, Custer becomes a lightning rod for the way people are arguing about U.S. policy in general at the time, as well as now when we look at back at the way the U.S. treated Native Americans. He bears some culpability, but the worst thing about his actions is that they were so normal at the time. He wasn't particularly bad. There were Sand Creek is an example of a horrible massacre. That's not what it was. But he also showed himself that it could be avoided. And so, you know, Custer's kind of in the middle. The middle is a horrible place when we look back at it historically. So, you know, singling out Custer for special opprobrium gives the rest of the United States an easy pass. You know, again, Custer is an exaggerated American. He shows what America was going through, how they fought, how they thought about these things. And yet he himself is not the source of those problems. That's the way I would put it. So I try to find, you know, where he does bear blame, but also where he doesn't, where it's more that he typified his country. And without letting him off the hook, it's a tricky thing. Same thing with racial issues and with civil rights. Other Army officers became leaders in the creation of civil rights. A man who was a year ahead of him at West Point, Adelbert Ames, not only throws himself into politics, but he is friends and allies with Black political leaders. He is on Capitol Hill fighting for laws to force every Army regiment to take Black troops. He's leading a state that briefly for a few years in Mississippi, he becomes governor. You have Black legislators, you have Black office holders in a Black majority state. So there are examples of how Custer could have chosen differently. Was it very common choices that he made? Yes. But also we know that he had a choice. And so this is Custer, unsatisfying, volatile, always creating problems for himself, a man immersed in other ways that I'll just touch on for 30 seconds. He was immersed in the new national media. He was a popular writer and public intellectual who wrote about the Great Plains, about his experiences in the West, again, presenting very much a conventional racialized view of American Indians who he admired, but he found a way to put them in a box and say, you know, sure, when they're out in nature, they're great, but, you know, they can't be civilized. Again, a guy whose personal conduct, he can be very respectful and admiring of people across racial boundaries, but when he thinks about intellectually and politically, he falls back into his old views. He was a man who loved the new financial, corporate, financial world in which the United States is moving into. He spends a total of 2 years in New York, all told, after the Civil War. He loves cosmopolitan culture. He tried to launch a silver mining company. He wanted to float the stock and get out quick, sort of like Trollope's The Way We Live Now. It's fascinating. And ultimately fails because he doesn't pay any attention to the actual operations of the mine. He's a gambling addict. He's someone who goes to Kentucky and spends most of his time dealing with horses in the racetrack rather than his assigned duty of chasing the Ku Klux Klan at a time when there was a major federal offensive against the Klan in Kentucky. He's someone who was, embroiled in art and culture, someone who was taking part in the first great institution in America as we became a more organizational society, the U.S. Army. And yet his reputation in the Army was terrible. Obviously, there was talk about him flying throughout the Army because there's reports in the National Archives and letters from both subordinates and superiors saying Custer's living up to his reputation, he's a problem officer. But then what happens? Though it was increasingly rare after the Civil War, in 1873 on that Yellowstone expedition, he has two battles with Sitting Bull and the Lakotas. And you know what? They're not crushing victories. He handles his troops very well. A man who has a reputation for being reckless and careless with his men, he's out in the middle of nowhere, isolated, handles his men well, keeps them in line, deploys their slender resources very adroitly. And his commander, who'd actually had him arrested on that expedition, writes back about how proud he is of how his men have done and how they've won these great victories. So Custer constantly creating crises, saving himself with his ability to win. And I'll just say that before I take some questions, in 1876, when he marched off to the Little Bighorn, he had created the greatest crises in his life. He had thrown himself into politics once again, despite his wife's misgivings, by taking part in the Democrats had won the House of Representatives in the midterm elections, and they launched a wave of investigations of the administration, which were really ultimately directed against undermining the kind of authority, the moral authority of Reconstruction. They're totally opposed to Reconstruction. And Custer goes to Capitol Hill. He not only testifies, but he walks around Capitol Hill with the Democratic leaders, a serving regular Army officer who's openly allying himself with the political opposition to his commander-in-chief. He's literally writing letters, taking a seat at the table with the Democrats, writing on Democratic Party stationery. He releases letters, the information of the press, and may even have authored anonymously letters or articles hostile to the administration and the press. He's gone to Wall Street, and he's been gambling, and he's been engaged in huge stock trades that leave his wife with a massive debt that she knows nothing about until he dies. He has created more and more crises for himself. He actually gets pulled off the Great Expedition in 1876 until he humbles himself before Grant and says, just let me go off with my men. I can't stay behind. And Grant relents, and his commander wants him to lead the expedition or his regiment, so he does. So he'd nearly, managed to create such a crisis that he saved his own life. So he goes off to the Little Bighorn, and there's a lot of talk about, did he want to win a victory so he could become president, et cetera. I think he was just trying to save his bacon because once again, he had made new controversies. He'd brought down opprobrium. He had created disasters for himself, and he needed a victory just to kind of get things back to balance. And of course, instead of restoring things to balance, he created one of the greatest rode into one of the greatest military disasters in 19th century American history. So this figure is much more important than just the way he died. And he's much more fascinating for the way he died. The Little Bighorn is important, but it's important because he'd had this life, lived on a frontier in time, engaged in the way America is changing, yet always having trouble adapting to it. A life that's filled with interesting and powerful women and their relationships with each other, a life that's lived on a frontier of race and of ideology, of all the ways we argue and think about America today and American identity. And, I'll just close by noting that when Custer died, it was a national disaster And yet it was a matter of public debate because it was an extension of how people argued about who Custer was and how who Custer was, what that said about who Americans were. And I think that that's an argument that we're still having to this day. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our audience online and on the radio that they're listening to T.J. Stiles speaking about his book, Custer's Trials, A Life on the Frontier, and it's time for questions. Who would like to have it first?
Yes, hi. I was curious, when you approached the subject, did you decide to write this book because you knew of all of this complexity in his life, or was that something that you more discovered as you wrote it?
That's a very interesting question. There's sort of a multi-stage process as I explored the topic. Custer is such an omnipresent figure in American history in the 19th century. You come across him again and again, so I had a certain familiarity with him. And I already had a sense of him that he was sort of, to allude to Breaking Bad, he's the Walter White of American history. You know, Walter White is this amazingly compelling figure, even though what he's doing is horrible. Custer, not everything he did was horrible. He did some actually really great things. I think the Union winning the Civil War is a great thing. And he did other things that actually were admirable. And yet he was constantly creating disasters and getting out of them. So I had a sense that his story was fascinating. But I began by thinking about his movements across America and that the way his life, if you simply follow the geographical trail of his life, it carries you across this amazing panorama of 19th century America. It's a big reason why I've written about this period so much, where you have New York, the modern Wall Street is arising, modern factories, you have telecommunications has started, photography, you have really the birth of modern America in terms of literature and communications and the economy and finance, you know, a sophisticated urban culture. And you go south, you have slavery and the death of slavery and civil rights and the fight over the role of the federal government. And then you go farther west and you have pre-industrial nomadic peoples. It's an amazing expanse that has so many dramatic conflicts that I thought, that's really great. And so I began to look into it. As I dug into it, I realized how many areas of his life have been obscured by the fascination with either the Civil War or, much more commonly, the West. And those are fascinating subjects, a big part of my book. But, you know, it really is interesting how he engaged with publishers and writing articles and how he was engaged with high culture and low culture and science and finance. It's a really fascinating story, in part because he's so volatile himself. And again, a key part of my book, that one of the big contributions, I think, is showing how he was actually a figure of Reconstruction and how he is very much immersed personally as well as professionally in the struggle over civil rights and how he represents one of the reasons why this great revolutionary moment in American history ultimately failed. You had army officers and people in the North who turned their backs on it ultimately. It wasn't just the South is to blame. Another question?
What happened to Libby?
He just asked, if you didn't hear it, what happened to Libby? This is a very interesting question there's a great book about Libby Custer by Shirley Leckie, actually Shirley Leckie Reed. And she goes into her whole life in much more detail. But Libby was – their relationship is fascinating because they had all these troubles – and yet also they were very passionate about each other. One of his letters during the Civil War says, you know, I know where I would kiss someone if I saw her tonight. You know, this is a lot of stuff like that. So they're very sexual, very intimate couple, writing in ways you don't expect in the 19th century. Those are the letters that survive. The ones that she threw out, I wonder about. And it was volatile. It was passionate. He was creating problems, and yet he was also needed her desperately. So they stayed together through all their troubles and loved each other very much for all their fighting and problems. And so when he died, it really was devastating for her. I mean, think about it. He died horribly. He died with great violence. His brother died, who served with him in the 7th Cavalry, Tom. His other brother, Boston, died, who was working for the regiment as a civilian. His nephew, who was named after him, Audie, died. He was also working as a civilian employee. His brother-in-law died, who was married to his sister. I mean, the Custer family was just devastated by this event. And Libby was very much a part of that family. And then she lost other friends and husbands of friends who died in this battle. She finds out that his he's got this colossal debt. It was about $9,000, which is more than the largest companies in America were railroad companies. Railroad presidents didn't make $9,000 a year. So it's a vast debt. I don't like converting into modern amounts, but that gives you an idea of how much his stock trading left her in debt. She even had to fight over his life insurance because since he was out on the Great Plains, he missed his last premium payment. You know? And they actually used that as an argument. Can you imagine? So, you know, after a little public embarrassment, they gave in, but it wasn't enough to cover all of this. And so, you know, the stockbroker settled, she was poor. Congress declined to increase her pension. And so she went to work as a secretary in New York, and she moved to New York. And eventually she got some money that was settled upon her, an inheritance to her own family. And she had enough money to quit her job and start working on memoir. And so she published 3 volumes of her memoir. And that started her in a career of public speaking, not only about Custer. This is a woman who'd always resented the limitations placed on women. And she finally gets a career of her own, and it's mainly about her husband. So there's an irony there, who she loved. She never remarried. And her second book, she found where Eliza Brown went. She fired Eliza Brown in 1869 when she was fed up with her being so-called insolent. And she was very proud of how now Libby had taken over the household. Eliza Brown made her way to Ohio, where she married a black attorney and public speaker, showing the way in which black America was changing, even though Reconstruction had been thrown back. And so after her first book, they had a reunion in New York, which is the way I closed the book. And there's still a divide there, and yet they also are two women who have been through a lot together. And Eliza Brown's memories and the time she spent talking to Libby inform her second volume of her biography, in which Eliza Brown's a major figure. And it's by far the best volume. It's really interesting. So she ended up dying in the 1930s. I would have to check. I forget if it's 36 or 33. And she was very old. She died in New York. Again, a major pull of the Custer's lives, which we forget. So she really reinvented herself and did quite well. And she managed her money really well. Her father and her husband were lousy at it. And she invested in real estate. She left a nice estate for herself.
Next question. Well, I'm going back for that one. The Tilden and Hayes election was right after he died.
That's correct, yeah.
That put an end to Reconstruction. Could you tell a little bit about, do you know anything about the politics of that?
Yeah, sure. What happened is that Reconstruction had been allowed to fail in state after state, and really Louisiana and South Carolina were the two states where there was still black voting and there were also black majority states in which black electors are helping to maintain the government. But there was so much white violence by white Democrats that the federal government had to send troops to maintain order. They'd retreated in all these other states, but they maintained them there. And so the 1876 election, it was disputed, hotly disputed. And people now say, oh, well, you know, Hayes, who eventually the presidency was given to, he didn't actually win the popular vote. He would have if black people had been allowed to vote. So, you know, yes, if you take guns and force half the population not to vote, and then you say the side that wished they could vote, you know, wins without a majority of the people who did vote, it's not simple. And so part of the deal of allowing the Democrats allowed Hayes to become president, essentially if he agreed to withdraw troops and to allow South Carolina and Louisiana to become white supremacist states as well. And so the election of 1876 that settled in 1877 is a full retreat from Reconstruction and allowing African Americans to have the vote and to hold office in the South. So Custer would have been very – he knew Tilden. He knew the Democrats who led the New Yorkers who led the Democratic Party. And I've gone through their papers. They don't talk about Custer very much. So that's why I don't think he was trying to run for president, as some people say. He just wasn't in the picture. But he definitely supported the Democrats in that election. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, when you mentioned the Great Plains and him going out far out west, how far did he go? Did he go all the way to Colorado and Montana, or is it mostly just the Dakotas?
No, he had his first deployment was in Kansas, and the settled portion of Kansas is really very much the eastern tier. And there were Low Plains peoples who were being displaced, who were the traditional enemies of the High Plains nomadic nations, the Pawnees and others. And so Custer spent a couple of years, 1866, 1867, 1868, 1869, 1870, with some breaks where he spent a lot of time in New York or elsewhere, out in the Great Plains and fighting against the southern, central and southern plains peoples. And he was redeployed before there was one final war, the Red River War there, which kind of concluded the defeat of the southern plains nomadic nations. So he spent time in Kansas. He did actually, he visited Colorado, Denver, because that's where his mine was. And eastern Colorado, he spent time marching around there as well. The Indian Territory, now Oklahoma, is where he won his most famous victory. And the Texas Panhandle is where he cornered that Cheyenne village and forced them to come in by taking hostages. Then he was in Kentucky and also in New York, but he was deployed to Kentucky for 2 years. And I did a lot of work in the National Archives, and it's something that people skip over. In fact, there was a massive federal offensive against the Ku Klux Klan involving the Secret Service before there was an FBI, undercover investigations. Troops that served under Custer were deployed to help U.S. Marshals. There was money being spent for secret investigations, prosecutions under the Ku Klux Klan Act. There was a lot of violence in Kentucky, and Custer wanted nothing to do with it. He even wrote an official report, I'd rather have my troops basically dig latrines than to be out, helping the U.S. Marshals. He didn't say dig latrines. He said doing fatigue work, which basically means that, those kind of duties. So after 1873, the troops are deployed to the Dakota Territory. And so that's where 1873 goes in this big expedition. He fights his first two battles against the Sioux. 1874, he led an expedition that scattered the Black Hills. And then he also spent a lot of time in New York, months in New York. And 1876, he goes back to lead this expedition. So he commanded Fort Abraham Lincoln. But again, he would spend weeks or months away from his posts in the Great Plains. Again, moving back and forth across the country, spending a lot of time in New York or places like Louisville, et cetera. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry. Someone else has the microphone. Okay, let's try and get in your question after she's done.
Of all the resources that you used to write the book, which did you find most fascinating or valuable in order to create this story?
Well, it's really a matter of putting them together. There's a lot of letters. Custer wrote so much. There's an immense amount of very personal material. And there's even more material that's probably in private collectors' hands now, unfortunately, material that I only know through other historians who've seen it before it disappeared. But there's an enormous amount of material at the Little Bighorn where Libby Custer established a library. There's a big collection of her papers, mainly at the New York Public Library, but also at Yale. A lot of really personal, intimate stuff there. It's really interesting. And then, of course, you correlate that with her writing. You read between the lines, you get a lot of that relationship with Eliza Brown and the tensions from her own memoirs that she published. And then also the National Archives has vast quantities of material because he was an Army officer for his entire life, and that you find fascinating stuff in otherwise humdrum reports, like being reprimanded during the Civil War because he would call a truce to go over and have coffee with his pals who were in the Confederate Army. They are the enemy. You can't do that, So all the kinds of little things that shed light on who he is. And because he's so volatile, you have to put it all together to create a sense of what he was like.
Maybe one
more question? I'm happy to take more. I'm not sure what our timeline is.
Would you be willing to share with us what your next project is, what you're working on, and where that came from?
Yeah, my next book that I'm working on now is a biography of Chief Joseph, who is the Nez Perce leader who in 1877, he and his band in the northwest, in northeastern Oregon, they fled toward ultimately toward Canada. And it's the last, and they were cornered. They defeated the army in a half dozen battles and were cornered just short of the Canadian border and sent off in exile to the Oklahoma Territory. And it's a really interesting story because it grew out of my engaging with the way in which our best ideals that came out of Reconstruction, the idea of universal individual rights, the idea of getting rid of these old inherited distinctions between people and saying we're all equal. When the U.S. government very consciously applied that to Native peoples who had had group rights. They were seen as separate nations who had autonomy and were treated with by treaty, et cetera. And so the same Congress, they said, we're going to get rid of that. We're all Americans. The same Congress that passed the Ku Klux Klan Act passed a law saying to allow us to prosecute these terroristic white supremacist groups, passed a law saying no more treaties with Native peoples. So, you know, it was – and so in Chief Joseph's life, the general who started the war and had some sympathy for him was Oliver Howard, who's the founder of Howard University and head of the Freedmen's Bureau. And so even though he wasn't an intellectual leader in Reconstruction, he was very much at the center of the federal government's engaging with emancipation and its consequences and trying to establish some rights for African Americans. And then how the same people and policies were then, when we went west, we said we're going to get rid of these traditional group rights in a world of individual rights. And we're going to get rid of their cultures. They're all going to be Americans. Some of the most humanitarian people took part in some of these destructive policies. And Chief Joseph is someone who he's admirable. He was very articulate about traditional beliefs in a nation that had been heavily influenced by missionaries. And he had to reinvent himself as a leader in a band and one of the most remote Native peoples to eventually having to go to Washington and New York and lobby Congress and go to Teddy Roosevelt's White House and, you know, delivering speeches that are published in major magazines. He becomes a major advocate. And so he has to embrace a new world that's very different from the one he was raised in. It's a really interesting story that I think is very, very important and troubling. And you know, it's not, again, not one of these clear black and white stories. It's one in which some of our best ideals are put to some of the worst uses.
Just 2 points. Could you mention Custer in Texas and mock execution? And the other was Major Reno's conduct and what the consequences were for Custer and Custer's state of his body at the Little Bighorn.
Sure. Right after the end of the Civil War, Custer is at his apotheosis, and he's played a direct role in the Appomattox campaign, and he's at his height, and immediately begins to slide down. And the troops who he'd literally led personally in combat are basically mustered out, and he's put in charge of entirely new troops he doesn't know. And he's now put on occupation duty, not combat duty, and forms up this division in Louisiana after the official end of the war. When I say official end of the war, legally a state of war still persisted, but you know the Confederate forces had surrendered. So he leads them into Texas to occupy Texas, and he's insecure. I quote Tolstoy, who wrote in the Sevastopol Sketches, an officer who feels unable to inspire his men through his personal merits will retreat into mannerisms or just avoid his men entirely. And the men will conclude, sometimes wrongly, that there's nothing good behind it. And that exactly describes Custer. Personal combat leadership, he felt very confident in himself. But when he's got to be a manager with troops that who haven't learned to love him by being in the pitched battle with him, he's insecure about it. And so he resorts to ferocious discipline, head shavings, whippings, which are actually illegal in the army, just intense, crazy discipline. And he has – men are deserting. They want to go home. The war's over. You know, these are volunteer troops. And so they catch a deserter. Others have escaped. And he is tried and needs to be executed. And they also try and put up for execution – a man for mutiny whose only sin was to circulate a petition suggesting the colonel of the regiment should resign for various reasons. And because of that, in a regiment that circulated petitions all the time, this was an American volunteer regiment. And so Custer has him tried for mutiny. So the two men are put in, up for execution with all the troops watching. And then Custer, in a great show of generosity, has the guy circulated the petition, you know, ready, aim, fire. Right before fire, he has him pulled out. And the guy is blindfolded. He thinks he's going to be shot, and he faints dead. Now the army considers mock executions a form of torture. It's not allowed by the army today. So so he has this one man shot. He has another man put through torture. And as we would now say, it's just a real low point. And so in those states where those troops are from, especially Iowa, Wisconsin, that's where you begin to see the press start to question Custer and to criticize him. It's not yet a national story, but it's a big story in places like Iowa and Wisconsin, Indiana, where the troops are from. They're really – newspapers there are like, this is outrageous. But it hasn't quite sunk in nationwide yet until later. So so that was a real low point. And then at the end of his life, you know, he had real trouble with the relations with his immediate subordinates. Captain Frederick Benteen was a very difficult man, hated everybody, really hated Custer, and Major Marcus Reno, who was the second in command. Now, those men were difficult. Reno was a guy who had a drinking problem. His wife had died, and he had a lot of troubles. But also it's Custer's responsibility to make sure that relationship works, and he doesn't really put any effort into it. So I don't put all the blame on him, but as the commander, he had some blame. So Benteen hated him. Reno had some competence issues. He had a drinking problem. He had real personal issues. And Custer broke up his regiment into three battalions. He took the largest one. He sent Reno directly to attack at the Little Bighorn with another one. And he sent Benteen to scout off to the left to make sure they weren't missing anyone. And Benteen is really resentful and doesn't follow orders, and he comes back. Reno, when he gets confronted by the Indians, he basically panics. Bloody Knife, who was an Arikara scout who's, you know, Custer really admired personally, gets shot and his brains get spattered over Reno, and he panics, and his men just like break and retreat. And Custer, meanwhile, is circling around to attack from the other side, and you know, once Reno's men get chased off, then they come back and they surround Custer and defeat him. Now, you know, that was obviously, breaking up his regiment was a mistake, and I think that Reno bears some blame for it. But the main thing is the people who, reason the Little Bighorn came out the way it did is because the American Indians won. You know, if Custer had fought differently, you would have had the same opponents and the same numbers with the same amazing collection of leadership. I mean, they really won a great victory. They were galvanized. They just won another victory at the Rosebud. He faced the Lakotas and the Northern Cheyennes at the height of their power and confidence, an amazing, huge collection of people. And they won that, and they deserve credit for that. Putting all the blame on Custer, I think, diminishes that. So Reno had a court of inquiry, which is the way I tell the story of the Little Bighorn, in which he asked – there was so much criticism of him that he asked for a court to inquire into whether he was at fault or not. And there was a lot of ugly stuff that came out, but the court concluded basically that the main fault was just that, you know, they were overwhelmed by superior numbers.
And Custer's body?
Oh, Custer's body was, most of the troops were ritually defaced. Their bodies were mutilated. Custer's actually was minimally mutilated. He was shot through the chest. He had a shot through the temple. And he had his thigh was slashed in ritual fashion. And someone jammed an arrow up his urethra. I'm sure after he died, I don't think he would have stood around for that. And this is a part, you know, I'm making a joke, but this is a part of the ritual of warfare. It's very much a cultural artifact. But Custer's, his brother, for example, was horribly, completely, everything you could do to a body was done. His eyes were cut out, his tongue was cut out, his head was smashed. And that was common. Custer himself, there's various reasons that have been given why. And one reason that has been given through oral tradition is that because he had had as a mistress or concubine, however you want to put it, a Southern Cheyenne woman after the Washita, and that the tradition is that she actually really had real feelings for Custer and they'd had a child together, which is kind of an open question for a lot of reasons, that Southern Cheyenne women said, no, don't deface him because, you know, because of Montecito. And that may be true, but, you know, oral history is tough and, you know, the native point of view deserves much fuller treatment than I could give it as a Custer biographer. So I didn't neglect their point of view because I don't respect it. I think it deserves better than I could really go into. So, but it's still partially speculation as to why his body was not so defaced. I don't think Libby got a lot of comfort out of it.
There's time for one last question, and I was wondering, somebody have one? I was wondering about what your take on. Okay, great. My question was on Sitting Bull. What did you learn about Sitting Bull from the two? You said there were two battles that Custer won against him, and then there's the last one, of course.
Right. Thank you. Oh, just quick answer. By far the best book about Sitting Bull is Robert Utley's biography, The Lance and the Shield. It may have been republished under another name. Robert Utley is a great Western historian, and it's a marvel of a respectful, thoughtful, insightful, vivid biography across a cultural boundary. I really recommend it. It tells you a lot about Lakota history and culture. And, you know, these really decisive battles are very rare in army wars against the native peoples, whether they're by the army or victories by the army or by the Indians. So these were battles that were a part of an ongoing struggle against the army encroaching upon the unceded territory that the government had recognized the Lakota occupation of the territory west of the Great Sioux Reservation. And so they began to encroach upon it with the Northern Pacific Railroad. They were surveying the route. And so Sitting Bull led to major attacks on Custer's forces. And the battles are basically inconclusive, but Custer could easily – other army officers in similar situations made terrible mistakes. Custer handled his men very well and in the end of the day drove off the attacking Lakotas. But it wasn't like he won a crushing victory or anything. So Sitting Bull is a fascinating figure in part because he saw that the significance of the conflict with the U.S. government, with the white soldiers who are coming in, whereas a lot of Lakotas saw this much more, as Sitting Bull did too, in the matrix of a traditional hostilities against other native peoples. The U.S. government basically recognized their existing domain and set up agencies that gave them rations and cattle and weapons and they were basically getting tribute. You know, they were not put in a situation where they felt like they were being confined. They were really, the Treaty of 1868, the Fort Laramie Treaty, really recognized their power and their domain. And so Sitting Bull is one of the few people who said, don't take the rations, don't take the stuff from the white people, you're going to make yourself slaves to them. And so what's interesting is the way in which he saw the hazards of that relationship before a lot of other native people did, who would go to the agency and collect the rations and then go out and hunt and then come back to the agency, and they saw it as sort of a continuum. We tend to see everything in terms of, you know, whites versus Indians, whereas at the time it was a much more complex story if you look at it from the native point of view.
One last question.
My question kind of relates to some question I've always had. All the deaths that happened in the Civil War seem to me, when I read tales of it, just men lining up shoulder to shoulder, and it's pretty hard to miss them. I don't understand the strategy, if you understand it or so on, the strategy of both the North and the South after the Revolutionary War, why you'd want to do that kind of fighting, marching across the field, shoulder to shoulder, people dropping because you don't even have to be a good shot. You're killing people. Why not be more guerrilla in that effect?
Well, I don't want to be too categorical because there's been some recent work that suggests that the longstanding explanations are not quite true, that there were good reasons why there were mast formations. But the mast formation started before the rifle. And the rifle is a spiral groove in a bullet that fits tightly in the barrel, which spins the bullet and makes it very accurate and gives it a longer range. And the older muskets that you saw in the American Revolution or the War of 1812 or the Napoleonic Wars, that's basically a bullet that's slightly smaller than the barrel and it kind of rattles around, a smoothbore barrel. So after about 50 yards, it could go like 5 feet off target. So you turn your men into a giant shotgun by having them stand shoulder to shoulder and all fire at once, and then they're going to hit some of the enemy. And then the enemy's in the same formation, so they're a good target. And so, you know, it was actually a logical technological solution, even though it looks idiotic. And if you had a rifle and you had to shove that bullet down from the muzzle it took you like 5 minutes to hammer it down. Meanwhile, like those guys are going to march up and that giant formation is going to shoot you down while you do that. So rifle troops were very, they were auxiliaries, you know, who kind of skirmished before the main battle. The Civil War, they had new technology, allowed much faster loading, basically. And so what happened is during the war, you had two things. You had them, they started to dig entrenchments and they started to dig down into the ground. And Red Badge of Courage, which wasn't fought, written during the Civil War, but accurately describes it. He said the veterans would, the minute they stopped, they'd dig at the ground like terriers. Like, you know, they wanted to protect themselves. And so that led to actual trench warfare. You know, the troops are trying to protect themselves. The other thing is it led to the troops spreading out more. And so Custer, as much as he loved the charge with all the gallantry and the romanticism, he knew how to make use of this technology. And his troops had repeating rifles, where they had a magazine, they could shoot and cock the gun, shoot and cock the gun, and he knew it was a big advantage. So he often deployed his troops in a dispersed skirmish formation because having a rifle, but one that you could reload quickly, was a huge advantage over the Confederates. And so he made use of that. That's an example of how he was a professional in battle as much as he had a romantic temperament. And so why this is a curious counterpoint to a guy who seems like the amateur at everything else in combat, that's where sort of it got his attention, and he engaged with modern technology. And so you see the way the world's changing. Technology is changing the way they did things. I like to note that when Custer won fame and won a national reputation as a romantic hero at Gettysburg, leading a charge with his, you know, his curls flying in his gallant uniform, a Confederate leader who dressed the same way and had long golden curls was leading another charge. His name was Pickett. But that was an infantry charge against massed industrial firepower, and his troops were utterly wiped out. And so here's Custer, who's that kind of the last example of the romantic hero at a time when literally at the very same moment that is being obliterated by this technology. So it's exactly that process that you just identified that Custer is living through, and that people don't want to let go of it. They don't want to be disillusioned. They like heroes. They still do. And so Custer, that's one reason why he's such a cultural figure, even though he was kind of a mid-level general.
It's a great end. Thank you very, very much, Mr.
Thank
Stiles.
You.
And I'd like to mention something that I didn't at the beginning. I mean, the book is for sale, and TJ will sign the book for you. But this book is now a finalist for the following awards: the National Book Critics Circle Prize Award for Biography, the Guggenheim Lehrman Prize for Military History, the Plutarch Award for the Best Biography of the Year Prize from the Biographers International Organization. Any new ones in the last couple of weeks?
It's a finalist for the Mark Linton History Prize, which is one of the Lucas Prizes given by Columbia University.
Great. So get your first edition now. Thank you very much. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Yeah.